Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Snehal Shingavi of the University of Texas at Austin, who assesses the widespread devastation from floods in Pakistan and the infrastructure projects that may have exacerbated the severity and scope of the disaster. Jordan Flaherty of the Louisiana Justice Institute, who describes the post-Katrina recovery in New Orleans 5 years after the storm as a tale of two cities, with one outcome for the well-to-do and another for the poor. And Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who discusses the significance of the end of U.S. combat operations in Iraq and the current agenda of the U.S. peace movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The notorious Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout, who sold arms in conflict zones across the globe after the breakup of the Soviet Union, has been ordered to be extradited to the United States from Thailand, where he was arrested 2 years ago. Bout will face charges in American courts of selling advanced weapons to agents of the rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Bout's extradition was fiercely fought by the Russian government, who feared what he could expose in a U.S. courtroom. Critics have long assumed that Bout enjoyed official Russian military protection in selling arms to rebel movements and governments in Africa. He also worked for the U.S. government in Iraq and delivered humanitarian aid for the United Nations to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Douglas Farah, who co-wrote a book on Bout titled Merchant of Death, says the Russian arms dealer was unique in his global reach. With the aid of intelligence services, Farah says Bout acted as a one-stop shop for weapons that could be delivered virtually anywhere in the world. Among the secrets Bout could expose are the extensive Russian networks in the Horn of Africa that continue to arm Islamic jihadi groups in Somalia and Yemen. While President Obama and top administration officials tout the safety of eating Gulf seafood in the wake of the massive BP oil spill, a new study by scientists from the Natural Resources Defense Council, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, raises concerns over long-term concentration of toxins in Gulf shrimp, oysters, crabs, and other invertebrates. These species have trouble flushing out polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, which are cancer-causing agents in oil and other fossil fuels. The seafood industry in the Gulf of Mexico produces two-thirds of the oysters eaten in the United States and is a major hub for shrimp and crab. Moreover, trace amounts of cadmium, mercury, and lead are present in crude oil and can accumulate in large fin fish like tuna and mackerel. On August 10th, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, reopened over 5,000 square miles of the Gulf to fishing, leaving 22% of the Gulf closed. According to Mother Jones magazine, environmental groups have called on the Obama administration to impose strict testing protocols to make sure Gulf seafood is safe to eat in the years to come. Retired mechanic Bill Rogers got a big shock after he came up short of breath while cutting his lawn in 2007. He was later diagnosed with mesothelioma, a deadly lung cancer associated with exposure to asbestos. For 44 years, Rogers worked near asbestos, fixing and cleaning brakes at General Motors car dealerships. In 2008, Rogers sued GM, Ford, Chrysler, and major manufacturers and suppliers of brakes and clutches. He settled his case in 2009. According to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, a second generation of asbestos lawsuits have emerged in U.S. courts from car mechanics, teachers who taught in asbestos-filled schools, and wives and children of workers who brought asbestos home on their work clothing. In 1989, the Environmental Protection Agency tried to ban asbestos, but was blocked by an industry-backed lawsuit. Legislation to ban asbestos in the U.S. Senate has been bottled up due to industry opposition since 2002. Facing millions of dollars in liability from judgments from asbestos lawsuits, Ford, GM, and Chrysler have paid over $43 million to consultants to defend themselves against victims' lawsuits. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
worst monsoon rains seen in 80 years. The nation of Pakistan has suffered devastating floods along the Indus River that have inundated dozens of cities and towns, affecting more than 17 million people, including 8.6 million children. Aid agencies estimate that more than 8.4 million acres, or 14% of Pakistan's agricultural land, has been damaged. As the floodwaters recede, there is growing concern about disease, food shortages, and malnutrition taking hold as Pakistanis travel back to salvage what they can from their destroyed homes. Early estimates found 1,600 people had lost their lives in the floods thus far. Pakistan's government has been widely blamed by its people for an ineffective response to the crisis, while aid to flood victims from governments around the world has been slow in arriving. With reports that the Taliban have threatened international aid workers, there has been growing concern that militant Islamic groups could expand their influence in the midst of the crisis, owing to public anger at government officials. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sneha Shingavi, assistant professor of South Asian literature at the University of Texas at Austin. He assesses the widespread devastation from the floods and examines infrastructure projects that may have exacerbated the severity and scope of the disaster.
The country is utterly wrecked economically. One-fifth of the country is submerged underwater. You have to remember that we're still towards the beginning of the monsoon rain season, so rains are going to continue for quite some time. The floodwaters may go down, but the rains will definitely continue. Even in moments of slower rainfall, we've seen new towns in Sindh be completely submerged. We have millions of people who are displaced internally inside of the country, left homeless, without homes to return to. And because of the absolute devastation to the infrastructure in Pakistan, relief efforts have been very, very hard to organize. So everything from camps for displaced people to setting up hospitals to getting clean water and food to people has been incredibly difficult to organize. And this is an extraordinary, extraordinary social crisis in Pakistan. The floods have wiped out one of the most important sources of capital that most Pakistani peasants have, which is their livestock. So you have, you know, goats, cow, buffalo, sheep, etc., chickens just being killed as a consequence of the rain because there's no way to save them from the floodwaters. It's an extraordinary loss for the poorest sections of Pakistan.
Professor Shingavi, what about international aid? It seems that it's been slow in coming to Pakistan. Why?
In the last couple of days, it's picked up a little bit, but in terms of what Pakistan needs, it's just a drop in the bucket. Current estimates are that, you know, we're talking of tens of billions of dollars will be needed for Pakistan to have sufficient money to reconstruct the infrastructure and to rehabilitate the people whose lives have been devastated. There are, in my mind, at least three reasons why aid has been so slow in coming to Pakistan. The first has to do with the American war on terror, in which everything about the way that politics, money, and economy are organized in what the United States calls AFPAC, or the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, are organized, have to do with American military considerations above anything else. And so for the last 5 or 6 years, the United States has actually been pushing this line that Pakistan colludes openly with the Afghan Taliban and, as a consequence, is an unreliable partner when it comes to the United States' military objectives in the region. Add to that what has become, I think it's fairly clear to see, a fairly rampant Islamophobia in the United States and in Europe, in which all Muslims are seen as either suspects who will turn into terrorists at any given moment or whose lives are seen as not as worthy as everyone else's, has basically meant that, you know, there's been a reluctance to give openly to the flood victims in Pakistan in ways that there weren't when it came to other natural disasters in the past several years. The third, and I think this is probably the most important one, is that Pakistan is currently in $50 billion in debt to international aid agencies like the IMF and the World Bank, and the primary way that that aid and relief monies are coming in to Pakistan, at least quickly, are going to be through more IMF and World Bank loans. In fact, a couple of $1 billion were just approved a few days ago for Pakistan for this effort. As long as the Pakistani economy and the relief efforts are tied to international aid agencies, it's basically going to ensure the permanent indebtedness of Pakistan indefinitely.
What is it you can tell us about the man-made causes of this devastation in the flooding in Pakistan, aside from global climate change, which is certainly beyond the control of the Pakistani government itself? But what has happened in terms of the canals and the irrigation of the country that may have contributed to this crisis?
Well, this is a story that goes back to the beginning of the 20th century when the British were still colonizing the region. Throughout the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, they created one of the world's largest irrigation networks anywhere. The irrigation networks are very, very good at delivering water to places that don't have water, but they're very, very bad at flood control, especially floods of this magnitude. So what you had instead of the normal flow of the Indus downriver, water is now redirected into areas that are very bad at holding water. There are very few flood control mechanisms that are built into the irrigation network. Add to that the replacement of dry land, and in some instances wet land, very close to the river, with agricultural land, which is quite bad at holding flood water, and you had a massive ecological problem when the floods hit Pakistan this year. There's another couple of problems that have also compounded the flooding. Because of the way that Pakistan has developed in the last several decades, there are infrastructural problems that go beyond the irrigation network, including power shortages, which mean that in many instances in Pakistan, you still have people that are highly dependent on timber for fuel, especially fuel inside of their homes. So you've had in the last 20 years massive deforestation, both along the river in Punjab and Sindh to create agricultural land, but also in the northern parts of the country where you have massive illegal deforestation taking place. And that has created conditions in which landslides have happened, water has flowed much more quickly down the mountains than it should have otherwise, really contributed to the flooding in a very serious way. This is a natural disaster in the sense that these are rains the likes of which Pakistan has not seen in decades, but definitely the kind of massive social calamity that's been created by the rains is a product of human intervention into the ecosystem, and that has to, I think, be underscored.
That was Snehal Shingavi, Assistant Professor of South Asian Literature at the University of Texas at Austin. Learn more about the Pakistani floods and relief efforts at laborpakistan.org. 5 years after Hurricane Katrina and the breaching of the levees in New Orleans, recovery is underway, but slowly. Three-quarters of the city was flooded, destroying more than 180,000 homes, displacing about 300,000 residents, and leaving 1,800 people dead in the disaster. Studies have found New Orleans metropolitan area has recovered about 90% of its population and 85% of its jobs, but much remains to be done in the Ninth Ward and elsewhere. The government's demolition of storm-damaged public housing has resulted in the loss of two-thirds of affordable housing units. Many neighborhood schools have not been rebuilt, downtown's charity hospital remains closed, and the city's public transit system has not yet been restored. Jordan Flaherty moved to New Orleans in 2001, survived Katrina in 2005, and has worked as a community organizer for the past several years. He is on the staff of the Louisiana Justice Institute, and his book, Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Jenna Six, was published earlier this year by Haymarket Books. It follows the struggle of New Orleans residents for justice after the disaster. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Flaherty, who describes the post-Katrina situation as an example of survival of the fittest, where those with the most resources get access to funds to rebuild housing and better schools, while the poorest citizens often do without or are forced to leave New Orleans.
During the storm, 80% of the housing in the city was flooded, but some of the housing that was not flooded was actually the public housing, which was very well built. The public housing, many of the units could actually have been reopened almost immediately after the water had been drained out of the city. But people with power chose to take this as an opportunity to close up that housing. Congressman Richard Baker, a Republican from the Baton Rouge area, said, you know, we've been trying to do something about public housing. We couldn't, but God did. And so they used this storm as an opportunity to shutter up the public housing and kick people out. And that's been part of the mass displacement that's happened to the population of New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina, is the displacement of the people that used to live in public housing. with that public housing closed in general, that's been part of the lack of affordable housing in the city overall. You've had, just in the last year, housing prices have gone up 63%. In the first year after the storm, rents in many neighborhoods doubled for renters. And part of the problem was compounded also by the fact that the main federal program to help rebuild, the Louisiana Road Home Program, was designed strictly for homeowners. There was actually no funding at all available for renters. Now, even within those homeowners, that program was racially discriminatory. It said just in this past week, found that it was likely racially discriminatory in the way it handed out funding. The reason it was racially discriminatory was because that funding formula was based on the property values. So wealthier and whiter neighborhoods received more funding to rebuild their homes than African-American neighborhoods. And on average, African-Americans received about 40% less funding to rebuild than white homeowners. This was an accident that was caused by the federal government. These levees were supposed to hold up to a Category 3 storm, but in fact, the winds of Hurricane Katrina that hit New Orleans were only a Category 2. The brunt of the storm missed the city and hit Mississippi. So we should have been able to not receive any flooding if the levees had been built the way the Army Corps of Engineers had promised. We still are in a situation with thousands of empty units, still damaged units, neighborhoods like the lower Ninth Ward filled with vacant lots.
Jordan Flaherty, New Orleans had a notoriously bad school system before Katrina, and it's gone through major changes since then. Can you talk about that?
One of the first actions that was taken by the city and the state in the aftermath of the storm was they fired all of the teachers in the school system, 7,000 public school teachers and other staffers, including janitors, lunchroom workers. They refused recognition of that union that previously had been the largest union in the city, the teachers union. They basically displaced that population, which was, that union was the largest source of black middle-class political power in the city. That group of folks, 7,000, mostly African-Americans, who lost their jobs, you know, that became much harder for that population to come back. It was a big part of the displacement of African-Americans that, again, cut across lines of class. You then had the school system, again, 128 schools pre-Katrina, 124 of them were under the control of the school board. The state basically seized control over those schools, and right now we have a situation where 5 of those schools are under the control of the school board. The rest are either under control of the state or they've been chartered. There are indeed some excellent schools available, but you have to be a student that has parents that really advocate for you, that do the research on what the best schools are and get their applications in so that they can get you into that best school. And so, again, it's the survival of the fittest recovery, where those who have the most resources going in get the best school, get the best housing, get the most recovery funding. And those that need the most get the least.
We should talk a little bit about the construction of a better levee system. And what about coastal restoration as a way to protect New Orleans from future storms?
The oil companies have dug 10,000 miles of canals through our southern coast. We're losing a football field of land every 45 minutes due to coastal erosion. About 40% of that coastal erosion is directly because of that oil company drilling where the salt water from those canals is brought into the freshwater marshes and destroys the marshes and erodes the coast. Hurricane Katrina would have been barely felt in New Orleans if we had the coast that we did even 20, 30 years ago. But our coast has been destroyed by the greed of these oil companies. And again, the rest of the country has profited because of this cheap oil that they've gotten, while the people of New Orleans have suffered. What we need is not just the levees repaired, but we really need a full coastal erosion program. You know, we need stimulus money to go towards creating jobs in coastal restoration, because if we don't restore this coast that has been destroyed, the city will continue to be at risk, even no matter if we had the best levees possible.
That was Jordan Flaherty, community organizer with the Louisiana Justice Institute and author of Floodlines: Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Jenna 6. Contact the Institute at area code 504-872-9134 or visit their website at louisianajusticeinstitute.org. As news from the increasingly deadly war in Afghanistan gets worse, President Obama, in an Oval Office address to the nation, announced the end of combat operations in Iraq, a war that he pledged to end during his 2008 campaign for the White House. While Obama highlighted the reduction of U.S. troops from 144,000 when he took office in January 2009 to 50,000 today, the drawdown comes at a time of escalating violence and the failure of political parties to form a new government after national elections in March. The troop withdrawal does not include 95,000 private military contractors, with the U.S. State Department planning to increase the number of security contractors working for them in Iraq. The price paid for the war launched by President Bush in 2003 is astronomical, with almost 4,500 U.S. troops killed, tens of thousands wounded, and more than 100,000 Iraqis estimated to have thus far lost their lives in the seven-year war, with a monetary cost of more than $700 billion. While the U.S. invasion, originally tied by President Bush to weapons of mass destruction and the 9/11 terrorist attacks, brought down the brutal regime of Saddam Hussein, the quality of life for average Iraqis has not improved. More than a decade of economic sanctions, war, and occupation has smashed Iraq's infrastructure, resulting in a lack of basic services, including inadequate electricity and high unemployment. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who discusses the significance of the end of U.S. combat operations in Iraq and the current agenda of the U.S. peace movement.
Well, it certainly is a step in the right direction, but I'm concerned about the continued very large footprint that we have. 50,000 troops is nothing to sneeze at. It's a lot of troops, and they're still going to be involved in dangerous activities, being potentially killed and killing. And then there are the tens of thousands of contractors, private contractors, that will continue to be there, the largest bases ever, five enduring bases, and the largest embassy ever in the world, the size of the Vatican. So our presence will still be very prominent, but it is a step in the right direction, and we have to keep pushing. It might occur that if there is indeed an Iraqi government at some point, they might ask the U.S. to stay longer, and we have to be prepared to be pushing President Obama and the Congress to say no.
And Medea, what shape is the United States leaving the Iraqi people as we draw down the number of troops there?
We have destroyed a country that had been living under 13 years of brutal sanctions and under a brutal dictatorship, and things are worse now than they were when the U.S. entered. People have less electricity, less clean drinking water, a health care system that before the sanctions was the envy of the Arab world and has now been decimated. Iraq, unbeknownst to most Americans, had one of the highest educational levels in the world and certainly in the Arab world. So it was an extremely educated society, and now the educational system is in tatters. That's not even to bring up the refugee situation, where there are at least 4 million Iraqi refugees living in desperate circumstances in Syria and Jordan and Lebanon and all around the world, and internally displaced over a million Iraqis as well. So we have really destroyed that country.
What do you see the role of the peace movement in this current period where, if things go according to what the articulated plans are, a troop withdrawal in Iraq while we see a simultaneous escalation of the war in Afghanistan? What do you think the peace movement should be doing now, given it's been fairly quiet since Barack Obama was elected?
I think we have to put the two wars together. First, we were so focused on Iraq that we forgot Afghanistan. Now we're focused on Afghanistan. We're some people going along with the narrative that the war in Iraq has ended. Put them together and talk about the wars, because that also includes what the U.S. has been doing in Afghanistan and the drone bombs that are happening in other places as well. And to say that we have to stop these aggressive wars, that we have to put it in the context of the U.S. financial crisis, if we really want to speak to what most Americans are concerned about and say we cannot rebuild our economy, we can't have money for our schools and our healthcare system and our infrastructure and the green energy system we need to build if we continue to spend so many billions of dollars on war. And so this new campaign that's been called Bring Our War Dollars Home is being launched in cities and states around this country, and I think it's a very exciting time to make alliances. We've been talking about for 8 or 9 years now, but haven't done a good job at building. The peace movement has tended to be white and older. And October 2nd, there is a mobilization not called by the peace movement. It's actually called by the unions and the civil rights organizations, NAACP, SEIU, National Council of La Raza, the U.S. Student Association, to call for jobs, jobs, jobs. And we have asked to be part of this and to bring in the message of bring the war dollars home so that we can have jobs, jobs, jobs. And it's been an interesting process because we have had to fight to get the language against the war into the call, partially because many of these groups don't want to go against the Obama administration's policies, and partly because many union members who have jobs that are related to the war industry. We're very excited being part of the building for October 2nd. It's going to be bigger than Glenn Beck rally in Washington, and it's going to be led by people of color in the social justice movement, and we are determined that the issue of money for jobs, not for war, be included in it.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the groups Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. Contact Code Pink by calling area code 415-575-5555 or visit their website at codepinkalert.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.